Thank you for inviting me, and thanks everyone for coming. So I think the title more or less sums up what this talk will be about. If you have questions, feel free to interrupt me. This doesn't need to be super formal or anything. Okay, so I'm from CETA in Toronto, and this is some work that I did with a few collaborators here, one of whom is sitting right over there. So anything I say outrageous is my fault, not Matt's. Okay. All right. So before I get started, there's sort of a basic overarching question that I am going to attempt to address in this talk to some level, which is how quantum is quantum field theory, really, at a fundamental level. And by that, I mean, effectively, to what extent can you take this really horrible thing if you're doing field theory? So you have a wave functional, which is in some infinite dimensional space and is really, really hard to deal with. You evolve it with the Schrodinger equation. To what extent can you replace that with some probability density functional, which is still complicated, but at least you don't have interference of paths, and then just evolve this using classical equations of motion? And so there are many problems where you might want to have some much simpler description versus this, and this is problems that are nonlinear, non-perturbative, non-equilibrium. Okay, dealing with a wave functional in that case is just a horrible, horrible, horrible mess. Okay, and so there's a specific problem I will be talking about that will attempt to deal with this. And this is a problem that generally people think is very, very quantum mechanical. As in, the time evolution is a quantum mechanical thing as opposed to having any classical description. And that is first order phase transitions that are driven by quantum mechanics as opposed to statistical fluctuations. And so a quick overview of what I will be talking about. I'm just going to quickly review what I mean by vacuum decay and how first order phase transitions are supposed to work in field theory. Then I will kind of review quickly the typical description people have for this vacuum decay process, just to contrast with what I'm doing. Then I will present the new thing that we came up with, which is a real-time description of this process that is effectively classical for all intents and purposes. And I'll talk a little bit about future applications. And depending on time, I'll maybe say a little bit about how we can actually test this using tabletop Bose-Einstein condensates. Okay? That's an if there's time thing. All right. So what am I going to be talking about? We want to imagine we have some field theory, okay, and it has a potential. And in this potential, there are minima of various kinds, some of which have more energy than other ones. Do you have a question?
Yeah, where's the potential come from?
For the purposes of this, not super important. Why did I pick this particular potential, or?
What does the potential have to do with quantum? Where does it come from if you're dealing with this, some kind of fundamental level?
It's just the Higgs say, it's a scalar field. So there's an interaction strength for the scalar field. Yes, we're just postulating potential. This is not some fundamental quantum gravity construction. Okay.
The false vacuum comes from, originally from condensed matter physics.
Yes.
All the way back to Ginsburg and Hunter.
Yep, for sure. So in that case, you deal with the free energies instead of the potential. Okay.
Sort of ad hoc.
Yeah. So this will be relativistic as opposed to non-relativistic, as it usually is in condensed matter. Okay. So we're just going to postulate a potential. There's a particular reason I chose this one, which I may or may not have time to get to, but okay. Just take this as given. The key thing is there's some minimum here that is not the absolute minimum. And so you can imagine taking some large region of your field and sticking it so the field is up here, okay? And then if you just did classical physics, it would just sit there, of course. It would never move, okay? But in the real world, systems typically try to minimize the energy. So at the end of the day, this thing really does want to go from here down over to this lower minimum. And there are a few ways that can happen, okay? Someone could just come along and hit the thing, and then it'll fly over the barrier, okay? That's one option. You can have some sort of statistical, maybe they're thermal, something like that, fluctuations around this minimum. And then they can occasionally build up a big peak that will cause you to go over the barrier. And there's a third case, which is tunneling, basically, where quantum mechanical effects will basically allow you to tunnel underneath the barrier. Or at least that's the usual interpretation of how this works. Now, obviously, it's a field, so you can't just make an infinitely large region all go over here simultaneously, or you would require an infinite amount of energy. So what will happen is some finite region will actually go from located here to located here. Inside, you'll now be near the true vacuum. Outside, you're near the false vacuum, and so you'll get a bunch of bubbles that will pop into existence. Okay? Oops. And then these bubbles will start to expand, and eventually they will run into each other, and the phase transition will complete. Okay? So this is dynamically what people have in mind when this process is happening. All right? And as a cosmologist, and since this is a cosmology seminar, the most common places that people talk about this sort of thing are early universe high-temperature phase transitions. So maybe you had some gut, and then as you're cooling off, you get symmetry breaking, and you can end up with first-order phase transitions. These can imprint gravitational waves in, let's say, Lisa bands. It depends a lot on parameters. Okay. Or the other case that people generally talk about requires using a much more complicated potential than this. Okay. And so you imagine at high energy, we have a whole pile of fields. They're all interacting with very, very complex potential. And so in general, that potential will have lots and lots of minima all over the place. Okay, and then you can get tunneling between these different minima. Okay, and this is sort of multiverse eternal inflation on the landscape is generally what this is known as. And you might want to know what are the statistics of bouncing between these different minima. Okay, I'm not going to go with such a complicated thing to start with. All right. So these also happen in the real world, of course. And this would have been a better demonstration last week when it was minus 30. But here's an example of a first order phase transition happening. Okay. And since we all live in Canada, people are probably familiar with this. This is a hand warmer. Okay. So you don't freeze when you're outside. And as you can see, there is a little kick given to this thing here, a small bubble nucleated and then started to expand. Okay. And then eventually you're in the new phase. So we would like a description of how this process happens. The difference being, instead of someone actually coming along and kicking the field, quantum fluctuations are going to cause this to happen. Okay, so before I can do calculations, I need a model. Okay, the particular model is not important other than the fact that it has a false vacuum. And I'm just going to take this as a model. There are basically three parameters in this. One is sort of the overall amplitude of the potential. There's one that sets the width of the potential. So as I vary this, while leaving, say, h bar constant, the amplitude of fluctuations relative to the width of the minimum changes. And then there's this parameter lambda that makes these side lobes go up and down. Okay, so this one actually changes the shape of the potential. All right. So now, given this, there are some obvious questions you might want to ask about false vacuum decay. The first is, how fast does this happen? Okay. Now, I've also told you, oh, it happens by bubbles forming. Another question you might want to ask is that actually how it happens? Okay? And if that is true, an obvious thing you might want to know is what does one of these bubbles look like? Okay? And so there's a standard way to answer question 1 and 3. Okay? And so the first thing that you want to do, I'm going to quickly review how that goes, is you want to get the decay rate. So presumably what you want is something like, I start in the false vacuum, I evolve it for a while, what's the amplitude? I'm still in the false vacuum, square that. If that decays as e to the minus gamma t, that's the decay rate of the false vacuum, okay? So this is the quantity you want to compute. Now schematically, what we're gonna do, and this should just be viewed as very schematic, you have your propagator from the initial state to the final state, okay? This is very, very hard to deal with. So what people normally do is they go work in Euclidean time, okay? So we're not in real time, there's no evolution here anymore. And in that case, this e to the iht becomes an e to the minus ht. And as you take, where this is some Euclidean time, and as you take this big t to zero, you'll find that this overlap goes like e to the minus e naught t, where e naught is sort of the minimum energy. What you will find for a false vacuum is this has a complex piece. Okay, so when you stick the complex, when you make t equal t over I, the complex piece will give you a minus in this propagator here, and that will end up leading to the decay. Okay, that's just very schematically what is done. Okay, and then there's some more formalism you go through. At the end of the day, you can convert, this overlap integral into a path integral, of course. Okay, and so you have a path integral in Euclidean space. and you want to compute the dominant contributions to that path integral. So you look for stationary points. And it turns out that the important stationary points are spherically symmetric in Euclidean space. Okay. So you make this approximation. The thing you're looking for only depends on the Euclidean radius. There's some equation you solve. And because this is now not an initial value problem, you have a boundary condition that very far away from where everything is happening, you're sitting in the false vacuum. And then the fact that you're going to have some structure in your potential, this is just so you don't get singularities at the origin, okay? Because I'm in spherical coordinates. So you go ahead and solve this equation. And typical solutions look something like this. So there's some radius at which there's a boundary layer, okay? And then that boundary layer has some widths. So there's basically two scales in this problem, the width of the transition regime and where it's located, and also the split between these, the true and false vacuum. Okay. So.
Hi, I have a question.
Yeah.
So are you are you really doing this in the path integral?
This is just reviewing what people normally do.
Okay. So are they really doing this in path integral? Like in a are they summing over general metrics, or do they assume that?
Oh, this is in Minkowski space.
Okay.
Yeah. No quantum gravity here yet. Okay. So you can just go ahead. There's again a standard way of doing this, or you can do other things. Okay. So you're gonna say I have an equation to solve, so I'm gonna solve it by expanding in some set of basis functions. And then you can be smart about what basis functions you're using. So you know there's a zero derivative at the origin, so you just pick a good set for that. There's again this overall location of your boundary layer. So you make a transformation to set the boundary layer at that position. And then this thing has some width, so you make another transformation to account for the width of that. And you just say, I'm going to expand my solution in this. Okay. If you want, these are called rational Chebyshev polynomials on the doubly infinite interval with some mapping parameter. Not super important what they are. Okay, and you go ahead and solve. And you will get what I'm doing in this graph is varying that lambda parameter. So that's changing the shape of the potential. And you do it for various lambdas, and as you'll see, you'll get solutions that look like constant, 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 then there's a transition regime, constant, constant, constant. And then as you change the lambda, the profile can change a bit. I just want to point out, relative to what people do, this has a few advantages. Your outer boundary is actually at infinity. There's no like finite box effect. You can get double precision accuracy very easily on everything, and it takes like, I don't know, microsecond to run. Okay, and you don't need to do crazy things like arbitrary precision arithmetic. Okay. Now, you can use this, and this is just proof. This is the coefficient that goes in front of each of the modes to show that we're getting very good convergence. Okay, so this is like machine precision round off here. All right. So, now that I have this bounce profile, I can sub it into the path integral, since this is a stationary point, and that will give me the decay rate. All right. So I found these solutions. If I want to turn that into a decay rate for the false vacuum, I take these solutions I found, plug them into the Euclidean action, subtract off the action of just sitting at the false vacuum. Okay, and I'm going to call that SI. The decay rate per unit volume is then dominated by an e to the minus whatever that action was that I computed. And then this prefactor is coming from the quadratic fluctuations around it. Okay, so it's a messy, messy quantum determinant that you have to go compute. And this is coming from the zero modes. All right. So I can see the decay rate. And all I did here was I approximated some integral via analytic continuation. Okay, so this is probably correct. All right. Now, the next thing that you might want to ask is, what does a bubble look like? And here is where interpretation of this result starts to come in. Okay. Oh, sorry. And so you do this, and you get a prediction for your nucleation rates, again, using this potential as a function of lambda. Okay. All right. So what does an actual bubble look like? Your first guess might be, OK, I've found this profile. And it's supposed to describe something that starts in the false vacuum and goes to the true vacuum. Maybe that's what my bubble looks like. And I started in Euclidean time, so maybe I'll just rotate back to real time and see what happens. Okay, so let's just do that. And what you will find is you, instead of a solution where a bubble suddenly appears and starts expanding, if you went backwards in time, the bubble also starts expanding. So what this is describing is some infinitely large bubble, contract, 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 get a minimum size, turn around, expand, expand, expand. Okay, that is not decay of the false vacuum. Okay, so what you do to come up with the actual solution that you want is you say, I'm just going to slice the solution off here, where the bubble is at its smallest size. I'm going to call that the bubble when it nucleates, and I'll just paste it in my spacetime somewhere. Okay? Now, remember, if I had started here and run backwards in time, okay, the thing would have also expanded. So if this is what you go ahead and do, there is no description using real-time evolution that would have taken you from this state here to having one with a bubble in it. Okay? And if you look in a textbook, they will tell you this is the most likely bubble to nucleate via false vacuum fluctuations. Okay? This is basically telling you there's no real-time description of this process. All right? So now you just take a bunch of these, you assume they're uncorrelated, and you just paste them into space-time, and this is supposed to be your false vacuum decaying via bubbles. All right. Now, there are a few questions you might have after doing this. Okay? Number one, I've done something that violates unitarity in a very, very bad way when I just slice the bubble off and paste it into your space-time. So you've done something that's maybe not super, super great to do. But you also don't actually have a time-dependent description of how this bubble comes to be. Okay? There's no way to paste the false vacuum onto some state with a bubble expanding in it. Okay? For example, is there a bubble precursor in the fluctuations before this bubble forms? What are the initial conditions for the bubble? Okay. There's also no way to go about getting correlations between the different bubbles. Okay. And something this matters for is if you have a first order phase transition and you're asking what is the gravitational wave signal from that, the IR part of the spectrum depends on this bubble correlation function. Okay. What happens if the decays are fast or have very large fluctuations? In that case, this expansion that is done to get the path integral breaks. Okay. And because I'm working in Euclidean time, I don't actually have any time evolution. I've implicitly assumed that all the fluctuations are stationary in time. So what happens if the background is evolving in time? Okay, so the field is rolling somewhere and then it's decaying into another tunnel or another trough or something. Or what happens if the potential is evolving? Okay, those cannot actually be tackled using the Euclidean formulation, at least in not any straightforward way. Okay, and again, the way the formalism works is you pick out the vacuum state by taking the Euclidean time to infinity. So there's no way to study non-vacuum states in that formalism. Okay? So these are things you might want to do that you can't do with the usual formalism. So in order to answer these, you might say, well, just solve quantum field theory, but that's a little bit hard. So you do need some sort of approximation. Okay. And ultimately, you want some picture where you have, I started from some quantum vacuum state, it evolved, and I'm going to add up a bunch of amplitudes, and eventually I'll see that there's a bubble here somehow. Okay? So how do we go about describing this? Okay. What I'm going to do first is give you a result, and then I will justify what I'm doing afterwards. Okay? So if what I'm doing seems outrageous, you can save your rage for 10 minutes. Okay. So what I want to do is describe in real time the decay of the false vacuum. So when I say false vacuum and I give you this potential, the first thing you probably think about is I'm just going to stick the field here and not give it a time derivative. Okay? So let's start with that. All right. But then you remember quantum mechanics is a real thing, and you're not allowed to do this. This violates the uncertainty principle, okay? Because I have a field. So to account for that, I now have to paste some quantum mechanical fluctuations on top. So I'm going to paste some realizations of random fields, okay? And these are supposed to mimic my vacuum fluctuations, which means I'm just going to give them variance so that it satisfies the uncertainty principle and they're uncorrelated. And if you open up a quantum field theory textbook and compute the two-point function for these things, you will get an answer, okay? And so I'm just going to choose that particular choice for the two-point function. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that the fluctuations basically are very localized near the minimum, so they'll roughly be Gaussian. Okay? You can amend these approximations as you go along, but we'll start with that. Okay. So this is all my quantum mechanics now. All right.
Can I ask?
Yes.
But do you also make sure that these fluctuations done already have the energy to be above the barrier?
This is a very difficult question. We could talk about this after. So most I will show you that you make bubbles doing this, okay? Maybe I'll spoil what's gonna happen. If you ask what fraction of the energy in the box is needed to make that bubble, it is very, very small. So it is true there are lots of fluctuations, but what you could imagine doing is taking where the bubble nucleated, cut all the fluctuations out from around there, run it backwards to your initial state, and ask how much energy that has. That's below the barrier. Okay. And it also depends on, okay, you can make the fluctuations bigger and smaller by adjusting each bar. Okay, it depends on lots of things, but that's, it is very hard to quantify this though because your field looks very messy. Okay, so having told you the answer at some level, what I'm gonna do is take some initial realization of the fields. Okay, so this is quantum mechanics for me. All right, and now I want to solve the equations of motion. And I'm not very smart, so I can't solve this nonlinearly, so I'm gonna get my computer. Okay, I'm gonna throw the initial conditions in my computer, and then I'm gonna go find some code, or write some code is probably a better description. I'm gonna throw that in, and I'm just going to, from that initial state, solve the Klein-Gordon equation, okay? So quantum mechanics, initial conditions, everything classical after that. All right, in doing that, I'm gonna work in 1 plus 1D for reasons that will be obvious very soon. So a bubble for me is a domain wall, anti-domain wall pair that nucleate and then start moving apart. So I'm starting from some random fluctuations around the minimum. I evolve it forward in time, and then some bubble nucleates here, okay? So I just started from a realization of the false vacuum, okay? If you went and measured the false vacuum as an observer, you would see something like this. Then I forget quantum mechanics exists, evolve with classical equations of motion, and I see something that basically looks like the false vacuum decay, okay? This is what I'm going to call a classically allowed vacuum decay. And this is very different than the usual interpretation where people say the bubble nucleates via some tunneling under the barrier that has no classical description, is entirely quantum mechanical, okay? There's none of that going on here. It's all just the fact that you had fluctuations here. Okay. And I'm not going to show it. The same thing happens if you run 2D and 3D simulations, okay? This is not special to 1 plus 1. Now, the next thing you might say is, I don't believe your numerics, which if someone just comes along and gives you a result that seems wrong maybe, or that you don't agree with, you should ask, is their code okay? So hopefully to convince you, okay, this is using a pseudo-spec discretization, 10th order temporal discretization that's symplectic, so these are really nice numerical methods. You can go test things like energy conservation, momentum conservation, you can vary the time step, and point-wise compare the solutions between two simulations. You can vary the grid spacing and point-wise compare the maximal difference between the two solutions, and all of these are 10 to the minus 15, okay? So this is the best you can do with a double precision computer, all right? And one other nice thing that you can do is you can show that this thing is reversible. So I'm gonna take a slightly different set of initial conditions, okay? I'm gonna run it forward, let the false vacuum decay. So now I'm up here, sitting around the true vacuum, and there's some domain walls. Okay, I stop the simulation, and I'll feed that in as an initial condition for a different simulation and run it backwards in time. Okay? And what I will do is I will recover the initial state. So this is a numerically reversible integration process, okay? And just to show that this is not a trivial thing to do, okay, suppose I do the same thing. Now on top of this, I'm going to throw on a different realization of the noise that is 1,000 times smaller than the initial fluctuations, okay? And now I evolve it forward in time again, and this time I stay localized near the true vacuum, okay? So this state is very special in that if you time reverse it, you will dissolve all the bubbles and end up back in the false vacuum, okay? Right. So this is a real thing, okay? This is not numerical error or anything. It's actually the solutions if you just start from realizations of the false vacuum. Okay, so at this point I've given you an existence proof if you want. The false vacuum can decay, okay? But I had a prediction for what the decay rate was just using path integral methods, okay? And just to remind you, if I could work in 1 plus 1D, the decay rate per unit volume, which is a length here, is either negative 2 pi, this phi naught again is the width of my potential, so you can think of this as changing h-bar, okay? There's some number that I can compute doing the instanton calculation. And then there's this really ugly prefactor. So this is the fluctuation determinant. What I have done is it has dimensions, so I'm just going to pull out the dimensionful parameter, which is basically the mass scale of the potential. And there's some dimensionless order one function that depends on the parameters of the potential. Okay? I'm unfortunately not going to compute this because it is not easy. This is work in progress. Okay. But this gives you a prediction, and on, except for this g, you can go compute c, and you have an expectation for what it should do. Now I can take all my simulations, and I can get a decay rate out of those two. Okay? And for that, I'm just going to Monte Carlo over initial realizations of the fields. So again, I'm going to define the decay rate to be the rate at which bubbles are nucleating my false vacuum. Okay? There's a little bit of wiggle room as to exactly how you're going to define these things. They will all give very similar answers, but I'm just going to say I have a way to find bubbles. I'm going to interpret this decay rate per unit volume as the nucleation rate of the bubbles, which is the standard interpretation that people have. Okay, so I get this simulation. Okay, and now I define the time when the bubble has nucleated in some way. Okay, now I'll take a different realization. I'll get a bubble somewhere else. Okay, is it not going forward? Okay, I take a different realization. The bubble will nucleate at some other time in some other location. I get another time out of that. And this, I'm just to show you that it's not coming straight out of the initial conditions. Okay, look at the time scale here. That's in units of the natural oscillation frequency of the field. Okay, this is not just some peak structure that's encoded in the initial conditions. It's actually like complicated dynamics that's causing this to happen. Okay, so now I do this. I Monte Carlo over initial field realizations. And this is why I did not run 3D, okay? Running a million three-dimensional lattice simulations would take a very, very, very long time, okay? Running a million one-dimensional lattice simulations is at least like a week, okay? You do that, and I'm going to vary this parameter phi naught, which is varying h bar. And you can rank order your times and ask, what's the probability that my false vacuum has not had a bubble form in it, okay? And you do that. And you will find these nice exponential decays. Okay? All right? And all I'm doing in each curve is I fix lambda, I fix the amplitude of the potential, and I'm letting h naught change, basically. Sorry, h bar change. And as a sanity check, you run this for one box size, then you run it for a different box size and make sure that your decay rate is proportional to the size of the box. Okay? So you do this, this all works out. Something is wrong if that has not happened. All right, so out of this, I can get the decay rate as a function of this parameter phi naught for the given parameter lambda, okay? And now I can go compare this to my instanton calculation, okay? And so again, there's this function I don't know, unfortunately. But suppose I set that function to be 1, then I get this blue curve, okay? If I set this function to be 1 over phi naught squared, I get the dashed gray curve. Okay, and again, there are no fitting parameters when I do this. The red dots are the simulations, okay? So what I'm doing is from purely classical evolution with all the quantum mechanics in the initial conditions, I'm getting bubbles to nucleate out of that at basically the same rate as the instanton calculation gave you, okay? Yeah.
So should I imagine, so first you set up your initial conditions quantum mechanically, and now at no point they are over the barrier, right, in the potential. And so then, and the field evolves linearly, basically, afterwards?
Or? No, it's nonlinear, right? That's the whole, you do need the nonlinear parts of the potential.
Okay,
you
basically at some point the modes will add up coherently.
The phases happen to add up in the nice coherent way to make your bubble for you. Now, just as a point of principle that you can make a bubble of almost zero energy, here's how you do it. So if you take the instanton bubble, that has zero energy, exactly. So now, if you just moved the location of the walls in a little bit, the energy is almost zero, but it will start to collapse, okay? So what you can do to nucleate a bubble that at all times has basically zero energy is you start with this initial Kolmogorov bubble, run it backwards to where it nucleated, and you have waves come in with the correct phase coherence or something to just move the walls in a little bit, and then it will shrink down to the vacuum. And then you could say, I'm going to take that initial vacuum flow configuration and add some fluctuations on top of it and run it forward, and you'll make a bubble. Okay? So there's no need to have like a big region go over the barrier. All right. Yeah.
So it's a bit like that. I'm a little confused. You're taking this field that has these fluctuations with these vacuum correlators with the deltas, right?
Yes.
Field and
yes.
Field momentum, right? And then you evolve it classically.
Yes.
Why does it matter if it's quantum? Why can't we just make these thermal fluctuations?
You could, and you'll get a different decay rate. But this is a very good point. So now you can choose any initial state you want, and you can do non-vacuum decays. But yes, this is a very good point. The thermal fluctuations have a different spectrum, of course.
And they will do something different.
You will get the thermal calculation instead.
So this knows about it being quantum really because of that choice of vacuum two-point function?
Yes.
And that is imprinted in the evolution?
Yeah, it's imprinted in this C lambda.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So it really needs to know about that. Or rather,
yes.
I mean, C
yes.
necessarily knows about that.
Yes, somehow C has summed up all those in the right way for you. Yeah.
What about stability of vacuum? I mean, classically, one expects the vacuum to be stable.
Yes. Oh, so when I say classically, that's classically with no fluctuations, right?
You what?
That's classically with no fluctuations on top of it. If I throw statistical fluctuations into a false vacuum, say you put thermal fluctuations in, then it will decay, of course.
Standard model, we're always worrying about the stability of the false vacuum in the universe.
Yeah, so you could in principle do something similar to this. That's just a different choice of potential in this case, yeah. And I will say a little bit, all the renormalization and everything is included on the lattice. You can't actually get rid of it, but.
Lara's question. So if it's just classical, it must mean that the initial energy of the field exceeds the barrier height.
So this is where things become complicated. So you've put fluctuations in. The potential you put in was the bare potential, right? If you then integrated out all the fluctuations, you'll get a renormalized potential, which exactly matches the 1 PI. Calculation you could do. So most of those fluctuations are just going into renormalizing the potential. Okay. But you can make a bubble that at all times the field has almost zero energy and starts from a state where you're almost localized at the false vacuum and ends up in a state with a bubble in it. Okay. Yes.
Can I just mention that you guys are being very sloppy in your definition
you're
of
right.
the height of the barrier.
Energy density.
It's an energy density.
You're right.
So, hence,
okay, this is the
subtleties.
Yeah. You only need a small region to go over.
If I wanted to say, I thought this was okay, you just have some causal configuration, and I guess there's a little tail that's outside, and that's exactly what we're seeing. Would that be right or wrong?
No, so this won't work for quantum mechanics, but this is a very good question.
That's not what you're doing.
No, it's important it's field theory. It's very important that it's field theory. As opposed to 0+1 field theory. Okay, so if you did that with quantum mechanics, then energy is actually conserved for each particle. Okay, energy in this finite volume here is not conserved. And so yes, you'll have tails where that particular choice of initial condition could go over the barrier. But what would happen is wait until the infinite time limit. The ones that had more energy than the barrier will have gone over the barrier. The ones that had less will have not. And so you get this two populations, the undecayed piece and the decayed piece, and you won't get an exponential decay if you do that. You'll get your surviving fraction.
Also in quantum mechanics, you can have tunneling.
But then it is really, really tunneling. Yeah. Yeah, so if you did, you would get it to be, there will be some undecayed fraction plus this fraction that has enough energy to go over the barrier, and it will have an e to the minus gamma t, probably. Okay, I don't know what this will look like. But you will not go to something where this is zero. And when I actually extract these are nice exponential decays that go down to zero. Okay, there's no constant piece in there.
but you said this, but what's changing with the colors there? You said it, right?
So phi naught, so that's the width of the potential, holding h bar fixed. Alternatively, you're adjusting h bar. Okay, so the height of the amplitude of the fluctuations, if you want. You can think about it different ways. And the reason for that is this thing depends on all the potential parameters. In the exponent, you know how it depends on phi naught and on lambda. So it's much easier to extract this tail without this order one function that depends on lambda. So if you varied lambda, suddenly you have to worry about what this thing does. Okay. Any more questions?
Well, in light of Matt's criticism, just to make sure. So since you're working in a finite box, is the initial energy of the field, the total energy in the box, smaller than the maximum of the barrier height times the volume of the box?
So for these ones, no. If you go way out in this tail, depends on the realization. But you're already in the exponential decay tail here. I mean, this is like three orders of magnitude in decay rates. So, but you can do this thing where you say, here's my bubble. I'm going to cut all the field out, run it backwards, and then run it forwards. And the energy on that initial slice is then much, much less than the barrier, if you want. Okay. So the thing that's important for making the bubble is much less than the barrier energy.
Everybody? It's UV sensitive, right? So it's like a cosmological constant problem. If you make the lattice separation infinitely small, then anything would have arbitrarily high energy. Right? So
that's another way of saying these things don't matter.
Yeah. The renormalization story is important too.
Yeah, I'll get to that. Okay, your questions?
Difference between field theory and quantum mechanics is field theory is relativistic. It has an infinite number of degrees of freedom.
That is the key point. It is not one degree of freedom. It is infinitely many. And if you ask about the energy in any finite box, it's not constant, right? These things can reorder themselves. There's phase information.
That degree of freedom doesn't work.
No. With one degree of freedom, you have an energy constraint condition. It's like if the energy is less than the barrier energy, you can't go over. That's impossible. But that is not true. You can make a bubble of almost zero energy relative to the false vacuum. But that requires having spatial structure, which requires lots of modes to be working in cooperatively.
So how many degrees of freedom do you use in your calculation?
This is a good point. So there are, I checked that it does not depend on the grid spacing. Okay, of course, important. It takes about order 2,000 per site. The key thing, you have to have a box so that, you know, the bubble is quite small compared to the box, but if you took the bubble profile, Fourier transform it, I'm expanding in Fourier modes, you go to where that drops down to 10 to the minus 14 or something, all those modes have to be in the box. If you don't include those modes, you start to find trajectories that never decay. So it is important that you have all of the modes needed to make a bubble wall. If you don't do that, then you've done something wrong.
The field has a non-enumerable number of degrees of freedom. It's uncountable.
Yeah. It's on a lattice, so it's finite.
You only have 3,000 degrees of freedom.
Yes, but those are all encaptured in renormalizing the renormalization takes care of all the UV things.
You can't do renormalization theory with 2,000 degrees of freedom.
It's an effective field.
Yes, it's an effective field, and we've matching onto your continuum theory is a non-trivial thing to do. Okay. I will say something very briefly at the end about this. But as soon as you put the lattice in, those fluctuations you've initialized, you could integrate them out and get the same thing as doing like a 1 PI effective action calculation. Yeah, and then you can say, I'm going to make my lattice spacing finer and finer and finer, and you can like do inverse RG that way on the lattice. But this is like not a trivial thing to do, so okay. I will quickly say all the renormalization effects are stored in that thing. So, okay. All right. Okay. So, I've said something crazy. I've said something that you may strongly disagree with, but I said I would give you the result first, and then I'll justify this. Okay. So, now I'm going to show you how you can derive this approximation I'm doing from quantum field theory. Just basic principles, okay? Or if you want, why does this work, okay? All right, so let's go back to the original question I said. We were wondering how quantum is quantum field theory, and a way of phrasing that is, when can I replace horrible wave functional evolution with classical probability distributions, okay? So how do I write down a probability distribution in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory? This is a well-known thing where you write down the Wigner function, okay? So you take your density matrix and you project it onto two states separated by some eta, and you Fourier transform with respect to that separation. And this gives you a function of phi and something that's like a field momentum. Okay, it has some important properties. One is if you integrate over it, you get one, like a probability distribution. And if you take any functional of the fields and you integrate the Wigner function against the Wigner ordered thing, okay, don't worry about what that is. Just think of putting this symbol in here, you will get the expectation value. So it does act like a probability distribution. You integrate over an operator over this thing, you will get the expectation value out. Okay? So W is basically like a quantum probability distribution. There is a caveat to that. It does not have to be positive definite. Okay? Having said that, if you start for a Gaussian state, it is positive definite. Okay? And I'm starting with a Gaussian random field. All right? Now, okay, so this is probably something we want to look at. Okay, so let's take the Wigner function. And now let's just use the Schrodinger equation to ask how this time evolves. Okay, so this is just quantum field theory. Okay, I'm making zero approximations other than it's quantum mechanical. Okay, and you do that and you'll get this evolution equation for W. Okay, it looks a little complicated, but now I can expand it in the H bar that's in here. Okay. And I will get an equation that looks like this, okay? So these two terms look like a convective derivative or a total derivative, okay? And I can kind of think about these things in a few ways. So number one, I have my initial probability distribution, which is set by the uncertainty principle. So there's quantum mechanics for you, okay? You should think of this phi dot and this pi dot as Hamilton's equations, so just classical equations of motion. So here's some classical evolution. And then there's some quantum mechanical noise, and this is accounting for all the horrible interference effects you get, okay? Now, if I drop this, okay, how would I solve this equation? So I have a total derivative here acting on a probability distribution. So one way you can go about solving this is to say I'm going to sample the probability distribution at some value of phi and pi, okay? I evolve it forward with these equations, i.e. along a classical trajectory, and that will get transported to some other value of phi and pi, and the probability density at that point is the same as what I started with, okay? But let's think about what I'm doing with my field theory. I'm sampling my initial field distribution uniformly because I'm generating Gaussian random field. I now evolve with the classical equation of motion, and I'm computing a statistical quantity when the bubbles nucleate by just averaging over those final states, okay? So I'm basically doing exactly this. All right, and this is some expansion to leading order in H bar. So you keep the first two orders, all right? So this is not making any approximations other than an expansion in H bar. And if your potential is quadratic, all of these terms vanish, which is making the statement that this is exact if you have linear evolution for the fluctuations, which is a well-known thing. Okay.
Didn't you say before it was important that the evolution is nonlinear for your story?
These are horribly nonlinear solutions to the classical equations of motion. But yeah. So there's a correction here if it's a nonlinear potential, but it's got an h-bar in front of it. Okay, so I'm doing a semi-classical expansion here. If you prefer, instead of working with an equation of motion, you can take a path integral, and you can expand your path integral in, I'm going to sample my initial Wigner distribution, I'm going to expand around the classical solutions starting from that initial choice of field realization. I'm going to expand in the fluctuations around that, and you will do exactly this. So this is an expansion around the classical, nonlinear classical solutions to the equations of motion from some initial.
But your conjecture right from the start was your potential was not quadratic.
Okay, so the way that you tap that up is your Wigner functional will not be a Gaussian in the initial state. Okay, so what I did was I said I sampled the Gaussian random field. That means I'm just stamping a weight onto each field realization, and I'm just making them equal. If you have a different Wigner functional, okay, I can still sample states. I will just have to throw them into whatever my Wigner functional is, and I'll get a different weight for each state. Now you can reweight all your trajectories. Okay, so this is a way you can start to account for nonlinearity. Okay. It also has to compute with this, which is like a noise term. Yeah. Okay. These are good. Subtle points, yeah. Also, as I'm making h bar smaller and smaller and smaller, that Gaussian approximation gets better and better and better and better. Okay. That's a good point. All right. Now, you can ask, how can you start to think about putting quantum noise in this thing, which is getting the interference of your paths? Okay. So I had, So I have this extra quantum term, which has an h bar squared in front of it. Okay, so I can just rewrite my equation and do an expansion in h bar. Okay, and you will find that for the first correction to w, it obeys an equation that looks like this. Okay, so I have to sample my initial distribution. There's some stochastic kick that it will get. And then this L naught is just the classical equations of motion. So I just do the nonlinear response of that. Okay? So I'm taking the same equation and just sourcing it with some noise. This noise has weird statistical properties, but it is in principle very similar to how the Fokker-Planck equation is related to the Langevin equation. Okay? With weird looking noise. Okay? All right. So I already sort of explained why this happens, okay? So it would have been very nice, since I've been doing an expansion in h-bar, if these curves had actually been right on top of each other, okay? So why don't they? Why is there a little bit of difference, okay? Well, I already said I'm doing the first two orders in my expansion in h-bar in the way I'm doing things, because the initial conditions have the leading order quantum effects in them, okay? However, when I'm doing this other calculation, the zeroth order is in the exponent, and then that horrible fluctuation determinant is the next correction in h bar. So these two approximations are not at the same order. Okay? If you want. Okay. So I'm doing leading order and first correction. And when I compare to the e to the minus s and don't compute this horrible thing, I'm only doing the leading order correction in this other expansion in h bar. Okay? So there's no reason to think they'll be exactly the same. Now, okay, I'm going to get into work in progress here, so I will just give some very hand-wavy things that happen, okay? Just to show that they have been thought about and considered, and solutions will happen. Okay, so if we want to get the next correction and actually make a fair comparison in h-bar, we need to compute this horrible object, okay? And so there's a nice way to go about doing this. Remember that my instanton solution is spherically symmetric, okay? So it's useful to expand this thing in spherical harmonics times radial eigenfunctions, okay? And you can do that, and that will factor your equation. Well, sorry, it will effectively diagonalize this horrible nonlinear equation, eigenmode equation you have to solve, into a bunch of independent equations. And they have this form, okay? So you need to find all the eigenvalues for this thing, okay? And again, you can show there's a negative mode in the L equals zero sector, and the d plus one zero modes associated with space-time translations of the bubble go into the L equals one sector, okay? That's some important details of this. But basically, you can take this and expand it as a sum over coefficients coming from each independent spherical harmonic, okay? So now there's a really nice mathematical theorem called the Gelfand-Jaglom theorem for how to compute determinants of operators, okay? So naively, if you have some operator of this form and you want its determinant, your life is very hard because you have to compute every single one of these eigenvalues and then product all of them, or better off, you're probably taking the log, but okay. That's a horrible exercise. Hopeless if you want to do it on a computer. But there's a very nice trick you can perform where instead of doing that, you can take a particular orthogonal set of initial conditions to this equation, you evolve them forward in time, you compute a matrix determinant, and that gives you the product of all these eigenvalues, okay? It's like a miracle. And that's super easy to do. So you can go ahead and do it, and then instead of having to do an infinite number of eigenvalues for an infinite number of spherical harmonics, you at least have turned this thing into a sum of really easy to compute numbers over spherical harmonics. Okay? And you can go ahead and do this. What I'm doing is the partial sum is a function of L. Okay. So now we sum up to multiple L. And what you will find when you do this and compute what the matrix determinant is, because I'm in 1 plus 1D, there's a logarithmic divergence. Okay? So this is where renormalization enters into this problem, is you have a log divergence, which is very unsurprising given that you have to renormalize all your field theories. Okay? And so, as I said, work in progress, so I'm not going to give you the answer for this now. Just to tell you, you have to do this. Okay, but then you're going to ask, what sorts of terms do you expect to get? Well, we know renormalization of like a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory is going to give me things that are like log phi squared in the potential. Okay, those will come down and be phi squared to some power in the fluctuation determinant. So this thing where I plotted two curves, one was constant times phi naught squared, one was just constant. It's not that unsurprising that changing the power on that thing might be the kind of thing renormalization does. Okay? And now just to quickly show that you can do this on the lattice without having to torment yourself with analytics. Okay, what I'm going to show now is if I just do this procedure I'm doing and compute the effective potential defined as the average value of the potential on the lattice, and also the thing that I differentiate to get the evolution of the mean field on the lattice, it exactly matches the thing you would have done if you did the 1PI effective action that you find in any textbook. Okay? So this thing that has on its surface nothing to do with what exactly you chose the fluctuation amplitudes and spectrum and this sort of stuff to be is the same as what I'm doing on a classical lattice. It's all included, at least to one loop order. Okay? And there are a few implicit assumptions in this calculation you have to make, which, okay, might not be good for the bubbles. So the background is going to be homogeneous, the fluctuations are linear, and the fluctuations don't have any dynamics. They're going to stay vacuum fluctuations the whole time. That's implicit in doing this integral. Okay? It is probably not a good approximation if you suddenly have a bubble nucleate. So, okay, don't take this as truth. Okay? Versus we can just define an effective potential on the lattice as the mean energy density. And you can just go ahead and compute it, and you'll get something that looks like this, where phi is the mean value of the field on the lattice. Okay? You use one identity. All right. You plug it in, and you will find that the effective potential on the lattice has this form. And if I differentiate this effective potential, it also gives the equation of motion for the mean field. Okay? But this is exactly the 1PI effective action that you would have computed. Okay, so this is already implicitly on here. And this makes actually matching to a continuum theory, to your lattice theory, something that has to be done because you've already done some partial integration out of your models. Okay. All right. And I will maybe say, I have what, 5 minutes? Okay. I'll say something very, very quick. So again, work in progress. Okay. So I said something perhaps extremely crazy. Okay. So it's always useful to have somewhere that you can actually test these things that you're doing. Okay. And we don't actually have a scalar quantum field theory we can build in the lab and watch form bubbles and this sort of thing. Okay. So there are, however, there's a field called analog gravity. Okay. And in that, people try to model linear fluctuations of quantum dynamics and Bose-Einstein condensates. What is very fun about this project is there is a way to simulate false vacuum decay in these Bose-Einstein condensate experiments, possibly. There's a proposal to do this. So what's the idea? The idea is you take two sets of Bose-Einstein condensates, so maybe two hyperfine split states of one atom or something like that, okay? And now you shine a laser on them. Or as Matt likes to say, you throw them in the microwave, since it's microwave frequencies, okay? And you can go through a bunch of horrible details, which I'm not going to have time for, okay? It turns out that because these are condensates, they're complex variables, okay? And if you study the dynamics of the relative phase between the two condensates, there exists a limit in which it will look like a relativistic field with a potential that is the one that I was showing you before. Okay, so this is why I chose that potential. Okay. All right. So then you can go ahead and, all right, I'm just going to skip over this. Horrible details. Details, okay. Okay. Believe me, it works out if you do it all. Okay. You can ask afterwards. Okay. So now, instead of solving relativistic field equations, I'm going to solve the equations for the Bose-Einstein condensate, which are nonlinear Schrodinger equations, basically. Okay? So they're, instead of being hyperbolic, they're parabolic equations. So on the surface, it looks nothing like doing a wave equation, okay? But you can go ahead and do this, and there's a way to adjust that value of lambda, okay? So when lambda equals zero, I start with the field sitting at a maximum. And then I expect some spinodal instability where the long wavelength modes grow, and I'll make a domain wall network. And this is plotting what the relative phase does. Blue is the false vacuum, red is the true vacuum. You see the growth of long wavelength modes and formation of a spinodal instability. You start to turn on the value of lambda. So now it's closer to being a false vacuum. It sort of looks like there's kind of bubbles in there, but it's still something intermediate between a first and second order transition. You start making the well more and more of a well, and you start to see the bubbles are actually forming in the simulations of Bose condensate. Okay? And all right. So since I'm almost out of time, I'm going to stop there. And just to give a conclusion to this talk, okay, I think it's important to keep in mind there's a physical process that we're trying to understand, which is how does this thing that's trapped in a false vacuum actually decay? And the answer to that is not necessarily some formalism that exists. It has assumptions that have to be made along the way to get what the picture looks like. Okay? And so I've sort of shown two things in this talk. The first is that you can decay the false vacuum just via classical time evolution, where you stuff all the quantum mechanics into the initial state. This is something that can be done, okay? And I don't see any reason why this shouldn't be called false vacuum decay, okay? Then the second thing I showed is that if you go compute the decay rates this way, they match the Euclidean calculations, okay? So these Euclidean calculations of the decay rate don't require interpretation. It's just approximation of an integral, okay? So you can interpret your next step in a few ways. Number one, you could just say this is actually an alternative description of the instanton that doesn't require tunneling and non-classical paths and weird stuff, okay? Or maybe it is a complementary decay path to the instanton. Having said that, because the decay rates are basically the same, if you think this is true, then that computation of the integral you did to get the Euclidean rate is not correct, okay? It's off by a factor of two, all right? Or, okay, to be very, very conservative, maybe there's some magical, wonderful cancellation of all the amplitudes that happens that somehow, I'm not including, but it's very, very hard to see how that could possibly happen. Okay, so if I had to guess, I'd say it's probably this one. All right, and then, okay, well, what is this good for? One thing is, okay, it's giving you an actual real-time picture of how this process happens, but there are lots of other things that you can go study using an approach like the one I just showed you that cannot be done with the instanton, okay? So one is, what are correlations between bubbles, okay? This can't be done with the standard formalism. Again, what happens if I make the background time dependent, the potential time dependent? For an example, cosmology is time dependent, okay? Non-vacuum states, which again is changing that initial distribution you're sampling out of. It's much easier to apply this to many fields in the sense that you are guaranteed to get an answer. If you try to solve the instanton equation in a high dimensional field space, there's no guarantee you're ever going to find a solution because it's a nonlinear boundary value problem. Okay? And okay, and some other things that are in progress. Trying to relate this formalism directly to the instanton. Okay? So I showed you that you can derive it from quantum field theory, but how exactly do you derive the instanton approximation out of it? And this involves all the horrible renormalization and fluctuation determinants and things that are in progress. And a guess that we have is if you computed the mean bubble profile, you would find it's the same as the instanton. Okay, this is also in progress. And then this application to BEC experiments. Right. And I will stop there. Okay, so the Euclidean decay rate is just an asymptotic approximation of an integral, right? There's no reason to think, there's no interpretation going into that. So you, so that's giving you some sort of decay rate for the false vacuum, okay? So you could take the view that that is a decay rate, and then this thing that I found, which is also a decay of the false vacuum, is some totally different process. Okay, if you do that, the total decay rate of the false vacuum is the sum of the two. And since they're more or less the same, you're basically off by a factor of two.
So you would say the Euclidean one is incomplete?
I would say this is in this case, yes. What I would say is this is actually giving the Euclidean calculation, there's this subsequent interpretation of what the instanton profile is, and saying this is a quantum tunneling event. But that came after you'd already done a massive reduction in the field space, and you're looking at effectively 1 degree of freedom. So you've sort of like projected into some subspace or done some marginalization or something. And I'm looking in like the full field space at some level. So I think this is just a different real-time description of exactly the same physics that the instanton is capturing.
In quantum field theory, the continuous symmetry breaking occurs for a very specific potential with a lambda phi to the fourth.
Oh, why didn't I use that? Yes. So as I said, the general thing, the actual numbers you get will change, but the general picture of if I run a lambda phi 4 potential doesn't change. Okay. You can still run it in that. You'll see bubbles nucleate. Okay. The only reason for choosing the sine potential is, again, this connection to the BECs. But what you still have to do with lambda phi 4 is the lambda that you put on the lattice is not the bare lambda. So you have to figure out how those two, you have to figure out how your continuum theory is matched onto the theory that you've put onto your lattice. And that requires actually integrating out the modes up to your lattice cutoff, basically.
There are no more questions.